Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Tuesday edition of the Toy Department in full effect. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. Did you have yesterday off?
I did, or I took it off anyway. Are we in full effect though? I feel like I'm in 70% effect. I don't know about you.
Yeah, but you know, if I come on and say we're 70% effect, then everyone's just, you know.
Is that a tune out? That's a tune out.
Clicks on to how did this get made or whatever.
Right. My bad. No, we're in full effect. So, I take it back. Yeah. We're in full effect of our limited capacities right now.
I mean, one might say that if, you know, you and I are at, you know, 50 or 60%, that together we're at like 120%.
That's a great point. I would say we're in extra effect right now.
Yeah, indeed. All right, we have a fairly light slate of homework this week, but not light in terms of the actual content.
No,
some pretty interesting things to to jump into. Let's
some
start
heavy
with the movie. Let's start with the heaviest thing, and I think the thing that I guess people are talking about the most, Judas and the Black Messiah. I was gonna say the story of Fred Hampton Jr., but that, and which I guess is, if you're looking for like a one sentence TV guide description, I guess works, but I don't feel like fully sums up this movie at all.
Well, you mean a Fred Hampton? Fred Hampton Jr. is...
Yes, sorry, you're right. Fred Hampton Jr. Fred Hampton Jr. is the... You know where I got caught there? Is that I think that may have been the most like devastating series of epilogue postscripts that I've seen in a movie in quite some time. And that's where Fred Hampton Jr. comes into play.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's in the movie. He's just in utero.
Stuck in my app. Yeah, yeah, right, correct. You're right. Unborn Fred Hampton Jr. obviously makes an appearance.
Yeah.
And then I guess is born by the end, but we never see him.
Right. Yeah. It is
But yeah, it's a film that stays with you a little bit for sure.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't quite as topical as it is, because I wish the world was better. But it's extremely topical. You know what it really drives home, which is something that, you know, over the last decade, I have realized more and more, but what it really drives home is just how poor our education was. Just how, I don't even know if poor covers it. False. How false our education was, frankly. I mean, I don't know what you remember hearing about the Black Panthers growing up. We didn't learn a lot about them in school, but to the extent that we did, they were basically framed as a terrorist organization. You know, they were framed as a...
Yeah. As radicals, at the very least.
But violent radicals, right? I mean, yeah. Violent radicals who missed the point. When in fact, they were... Yes, occasionally violent, but I think as this movie frames quite well, the mission statement was equality, and it was a mission that at that time, and probably still now, if we're honest with ourselves, may require some violence to achieve an incredibly, not just admirable, but important goal. And... the entire white supremacist-based culture framed these people as violent criminals when in fact they were desperately trying to protect themselves from an oppressive state. I mean, that's what it was. And that's certainly something I learned more about before I watched this movie. But that was the biggest thing for me from this movie, is that people who were desperate to be recognized as people were driven to extreme means at times, but also were smart, thoughtful people who were doing everything they could to raise up their community, not above any other, but to an acceptable level. That's it. That's all they wanted.
At like 20, 21 years old, too, which I think is a thing that really kind of gets lost. In fact, it's another part of that sort of postscript epilogue where you're like, oh, shit, he died at 21?
21. 21, and just a brilliant guy, a self-educated, brilliant guy who really thought about this stuff in like, this, none of this was undertaken lightly. I mean, that's one of the things that stands out as well, is certainly at least the leaders of the Black Panther movement were people who were deeply invested in trying to understand how to make a functioning society. A society that respected them, again, respected them as fully realized human beings. And I we're still not there.
Yeah, you know, there were a couple of scenes, you know, on the FBI side that I felt were sort of illuminating. There's one where Jesse Plemons is talking about, you don't get equality at the point of a gun. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yep.
And he's like, you don't get equality. And it was like, you're walking away from that where then, okay, well, where do you get equality? Is it really is really your idea that you're supposed to sit around and wait until somebody decides that you deserve it?
I know.
We've seen how that plays out.
That whole line is a bigger, it's just like a bigger view. It's a more important, deeper, you know, lot going on to it version of the Colin Kaepernick thing. It really is. Oh, sure. No. Look, we want Black people not to be murdered en masse by police, but good God, you can't do that by kneeling during the national anthem.
this is not an appropriate place to do that.
Well, you know, like, obviously that seems trivial next to the sort of violence and again, state-approved oppression that was happening at this time and in this film, but it exposes the lie of it. Because you told people that, hey, look, the gun is not the right way. The violence is not the right way to get your equality. And yet, you know, 50 years later, 40, 50 years later, kneeling isn't the right way either.
Right. But when we feel that something has been taken from us, it's
murder.
Perfectly okay if we kill police
right.
With American flags.
Well, yeah, I mean that's a whole other that's a whole other thing. And look, I don't know whether the you know I can't even with that. Obviously, but I think that's more of a idiot populist approach from that side. I don't think that's ever been the governmental approach. The governmental approach is nearly as offensive, though. You know, but it's just, and again, back then it was J. Edgar Hoover could be openly racist to the entire FBI and nobody blinked an eye, right? So it's not that nothing has changed. It's that the fundamental operation of the state and state supporters who benefit from these systems that have oppressed people of color for the entire history of our country, they're deeply attached to those systems that oppress people of color because they're the same systems that put them in power.
Well, and by the way, I thought Martin Sheen in
excellent,
pretty limited amount of screen time was really, really great.
Everybody in this movie is Hoover. Excellent. There's nothing in this. I mean, you know, it's like 90 something on Rotten Tomatoes and 87% Metacritic, and it could be higher. There is not a wart on this film, and maybe that's something we should have already said by now. This is a spectacular movie.
Yeah, and it's a. It to me, it's really the way it unfolds and the way it's plotted and the way that it grips you is fairly unique. It has a kind of its own rhythm, which I thought was really cool. But what I was gonna say was that was the other scene that I think like jumped out at me in terms of the point of the movie when Hoover and the agent are, you know, having that conversation in his office, and he's asking about his daughter, and you understand that in the state's mind, or at least in the, you know, the mind of the guy who's running the police state at the time, America's yeah. police state, that giving equality to the black community in his mind means that they're going to rape and pillage, and that they're
right.
And it immediately goes to, you know, what if he brought your, you know, what happens when your daughter brings home a black man? Cause that's going to happen someday, which obviously, you know, hits me pretty personally. So, yeah, you know, I am the nightmare future of someone's past.
Well, and I do think that's important. That, like, you know, we don't know if J. Edgar Hoover said that, but we do know for sure that was the operational attitude of the, as you said, police state at that time. Like, that's. It comes from this desperate fear where you have ignorantly othered this entire group of people and presumed that essentially, again, that they are not actual people. They're not like us. That's the presumption. Those people
our way of
are
life.
Not. Yeah. The, all they want to destroy our way of life when in actuality, they just want to live your way of life. Like, they just want to be treated with the same respect and dignity that you treat your people. It's not complicated. It really isn't complicated. And the fear and terror and the knowledge, watching this movie, the knowledge of how many people in this country still view anyone who doesn't look like them in that way, it's depressing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's – I mean, I think that is the fundamental thing that runs through it, right, is that there are people who are still worried about – our way of life disappearing if other people are just allowed to exist.
And it's so silly because many of those same people are complaining about their way of life and how it's not going as well as they want it to. And yet they're desperately afraid that, oh God, but no, if we let the blacks have rights, then they'll ruin everything. But you just told me everything was already ruined.
Yeah,
you know, none of it holds together under the slightest bit of scrutiny. And I look, we know this. We're treading well trodden ground when we talk about the you know, idiot racists. But this movie hits you with a hammer. It does, and it's in some ways a tough watch, but it's also so well made and so well acted and so well written, and it looks incredible. It brings you into some of these rooms in ways that feel original and powerful. And you know, we haven't even said his name yet, but Daniel Kaluuya is so good. He's so good. He plays this character, he brings Fred Hampton to life in a way that 80% of this country, I'm sure, had never imagined or thought about or seen in any way. And the power of the rhetoric combined with the humanity of the guy is a powerful thing to watch.
I think it's his greatest performance, you know, at least that I've seen.
Yeah, which is saying something, because he's always good.
Yeah, he's never bad. But I honestly think it's really cool to sort of watch him, you know, be the guy from that Black Mirror episode with the, you know, the shard of glass to his throat to come from that, which was, you know, not a bad performance at all. But like, you know, to watch him sort of Rowe as an actor to the point where he could pull off something like this, I think was has been sort of a cool journey. I would also say the choices that he's generally made, mm-hmm. right? Like, he's been in great roles in great movies, right? I can't think of the crappy movie he's been in.
It's pretty incredible, actually. The handful of movies that start his career aren't necessarily anything to write home about. But starting in 2015, here are the films that Daniel Kaluuya has been in: Sicario, Get Out, Black Panther, Widows, Queen and Slim, some sort of Christmas Carol movie where he was just a voice, and then Judas and the Black Messiah. Like, that's just a murderer's row of just excellent and many of them important films. Like, he has made clearly very deliberate choices, and what a career. What an actor. I mean, and he's 31 years old. You know, the best is probably still yet to come. So big praise for Daniel Kaluuya from my end, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to ask you, what did you think of Lakeith Stanfield's character? Not so much performance, but like his sort of role in all of this. Like, you know, it's weird. Like, I feel like the movie really almost kind of doesn't take a stance on them until maybe that sort of that, you know, I mean, his is probably the biggest gut punch of that killer epilogue. You know what I mean? That certainly implies that, you know, he looked back on that period with tremendous, tremendous guilt. You know what I mean? Which I wouldn't say is necessarily wrong or incorrect. I'm just curious where you sort of landed on him or landed on that character and his role in the story through all of it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's an impossible... I mean, morally speaking, it's an impossible thing for me to judge. I think we obviously, you know, anyone can look at the actions of William O'Neill and say he betrayed his people. He also was a victim of the same police state that those people were fighting against, you know?
Right.
Like, this was not a man who set out to betray anyone. He was not a spy by craft. He was cornered and he was made to do something that, you know, if we're to believe the performance, and I don't see any reason not to, he was never totally comfortable with. It was always an upsetting thing, but he felt like he had no choice. He felt like it was his life or he had to do these things. And you know, it's hard to say in retrospect because, like, we don't know about these private conversations in real life. It's hard to say how much he realized that the things he was being told by the FBI were misleading, if not outright lies. It's hard to say what was going through his head each step of the way as he sort of went further into betraying the Black Panther Party, because ultimately this essentially ended the Black Panther Party. I think, you know, the best thing we can use to judge is that literally the day that a documentary aired covering these events, he committed suicide, tells you obviously he was racked with guilt. Yeah. He was torn apart to the point of ending his own life about what he did. And I thought, you know, again, another excellent... Look, we know how good Lakeith Stanfield is, right? Nobody has to...
Right.
It's pretty incredible that guy is the, like, goofy friend from Atlanta, right? I mean, that's really where you and I think, got to know Lakeith Stanfield, is like, oh, he's that hilarious guy who just says weird stuff in Atlanta.
Yeah. And, but now we've seen him do so many things.
Exactly. You know, now I mean, we know. Like,
yeah.
We know what he's capable of, but I thought he played it really interestingly. I thought there was a lot of subtlety to the way he tried to play the emotions of that character. You know, I mean, and Jesse Plemons, too, like, you mentioned that scene where Martin Sheen asked him about his daughter. And I just thought, watching Jesse Plemons' face as he attempted to answer that question, because you don't you sort of get the feeling that Jesse Plemons, while certainly a part of the government machine, and certainly, look, long way to go if he wanted to be an ally to the black community, he is not played as a virulent racist. He's played as a guy who buys...
He's a cog in the machine.
Well, he buys the company line that the Black Panthers are doing it the wrong way, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't get the feeling that, you know, before that state, before Martin Sheen asks him, what happens if your daughter brings home a black guy, you never get the feeling that that's something that would deeply disturb him, right? Like, he... it's just, and then his face when he's asked that question, as he, you know, you watch him, first of all, considering the question, second of all, realizing in that moment that his boss is approaching this in a way that he is not.
Yeah.
With hate in his heart for that community. And then also knowing he has to answer it the right way to keep his job. Like, I thought there were so many moments that Jesse Plemons played with a level of complication that is human. Now, look, that is not an admirable character. He did horrible things, and he was part of a machine that did even worse things. But he's a complicated character. And I thought everyone in this film did a really good job of bringing those complications just to their faces as they acted.
100%. It's a incredibly well-acted movie all the way around. Shout out to my boy Shit Stain from You're the Worst.
That I couldn't remember if he was Shit Stain or what was the other one. Like, the two names of those dudes were both ridiculous and hilarious. But yeah, I you know, again, a guy who we'd only really seen do one silly thing, but playing a very serious role and doing it well. Again, there's not a wart on this movie. It's just excellent.
Yeah, for sure. Good times. Do you want to switch to good times or bad times next?
Maybe we save the good times for last, huh?
Okay. All right. Well, that would bring us to Framing Britney Spears, which is certainly not a good time, but I think a really interesting one.
Yep. You were right.
You know, you've probably heard a fair amount about this story. It's caused some buzz, and I think hopefully some movement in the actual Britney Spears case, which I guess is going back to court. Did you find this? I mean, obviously we lived through these events, and she was super famous while it's happening. So it's a story that you feel like you're going to know. But I found this to be really illuminating and full of things that I had forgotten or didn't know at all, or you know, looking back now in a present day context, like, feel really fucked up, if that makes sense.
Yes.
You have that same feeling.
Yes. So there were two big things for me here. One is, if I were a person with more time to spare, I would really want to dig into the sort of laws of custodianship, conservatorship rather. I don't get it. I don't get what's happening here. And I can't for the life of me understand, even if they thought Britney was utterly compromised mentally, which I don't know that there is much evidence of, even if they thought she was completely compromised, if she asked for an independent conservator, why would any judge not grant that? I don't understand why a detached father who clearly inspires fear in the person at question would ever be given that responsibility, much less continued to be allowed to have that responsibility as he does things that are clearly against the best interests of the person he's supposed to be taking care of. Like, it's just mind-boggling to me that of all, I mean, it seems like from this documentary, the conservatorship should not exist. Okay.
Well, but conservatorships are just not designed for this situation. Right. Like, they're designed for elderly people who have lost their faculties and aren't going to regain them.
Okay,
right?
but that's sort of my point. Like, let's say there's an elderly person who's pretty much lost their faculties and doesn't seem like they're going to regain them. But the one thing they are saying is, my son is not trustworthy. I would not like him to be my conservator. Could you just give it to somebody independent? Like, what possible argument against an impartial, independent conservator could there be? So that's one thing. I don't understand legally.
So I can get into this a little bit. I do understand, right? The conservator, her conservatorship is two parts, right? Like, there's the financial part, and that actually is run by an independent, right? There's a bank.
No, they just, but just last year, they added a bank, but her dad is still there. The bank
right.
is
and
just
he
like,
has her person. Right?
He has like her that's, person, that's... and he has ultimate control over the finances as well. The bank is just like an adjunct piece of it that they finally were able to add on. But again, if the dad is spending money, and it's being spent in ways that Brittany does not approve of, what possible argument could there be that an independent – if he's doing the right thing, the independent people should come to the same conclusion. But why would you
and
ever?
It's like if you have a high functioning conservator, then what are we talking about here, right?
Right.
Like,
no, agreed.
The whole point is you should be because you can't function, and these conservatorships, right? Because they're designed for elderly people who aren't going to regain their faculties.
Yeah.
There's not much of an exit path for anybody.
Right.
Right.
So that's one side of it, right? And that is very difficult for me to understand. And I get your point that it's not designed for this, but at the same time, like, it just seems to me like a judge at some point should recognize some obvious things here and say, you know what, it's the path out of conservatorship is not clear legally, but we can at least detach a man whose motives are in question. And assign.
I think that's going to happen.
So hopefully,
largely because of this documentary. That would be my guess.
But it should not take and honestly, and we can get to this, but it should not take a what I would say pretty mediocre and information deficient New York Times documentary to make that happen. That's absurd. but the other part,
I have some sympathy for the New York Times on the information deficient part.
I'm not saying I don't have sympathy. Yeah. I'm just that's a fact. They don't have.
You're not getting any participation for the principal subjects, right?
Well, of course, but that's my point. The judge has even more information, and again, maybe that's why things haven't changed. But that doesn't make sense to me. It just doesn't make sense that they wouldn't have let somebody independent take control a long time ago. Never mind tomorrow. But really, that to me is almost secondary because. Because it's so low information when it comes to the actual court case and actual Brittany, almost the bigger piece of this to me is the mirror that it holds up to all of us for the way we behaved in the late 90s and early 2000s surrounding young women. And look, I don't think I'm one of the guiltiest parties here, but I would be absolutely lying if I didn't say that I felt some guilt for not necessarily anything I said, but just the way I consumed culture at that time and that these things did not bother me more. A friend of mine who I've mentioned a number of times on this podcast, Jordan Cruciola, in response to this, tweeted a bunch of stuff about just not just Brittany, but just the way popular culture consumed young women at the turn of the millennium. And it's horrifying. I mean, she tweeted a profile of Lindsay Lohan from, I think it was Rolling Stone. It was either Rolling Stone or Vanity Fair. It was a big, you know, major magazine profile of an 18, just turned 18 Lindsay Lohan. And it begins with an adult male writer ogling her breasts and asking if they're real. That's how the article starts. About an 18-year-old.
Yeah, that's bad.
It's upsetting.
Yeah.
And looking at the way that that we as a society first over-sexualized Britney and then shamed her for being over-sexualized is, I can't believe that was 20 years ago, man. It feels like 50. And it's embarrassing.
That's part of it. And to me, it's a little bit deeper. You know, look, obviously people watch these journalists ask, you know, generally old creepy male journalists asking questions about her sexuality. And it just feels icky. And it is. But I would submit to you that questions about her sexuality were somewhat relevant, and that was primarily the way that her music was being marketed. And so to me, those questions are about like a machine that took a underage girl.
Yeah.
Right. And commodified her sexuality from literally the first single of her existence. Right. So,
well, it almost seemed like, and they don't explicitly say this, but it kind of feels when they're going through her early career, like her career was young girl with a ton of talent, goes to New York, gets on Mickey Mouse Club, is having some success, loves doing it. And then right around the time she turns 15, she's no longer of interest to the industry unless it's about sexuality.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I think that's fair and gross.
Really?
And
super
and
fucking gross.
And right, I mean, that's, you could say that's also Christina Aguilera's story, right?
Like, yeah. So, yeah, and look, she may have come out of it a little better, but that to me feels more like luck and coincidence than anything, you know?
Well, yeah, and I would say, the other part of this, and it's weird because I feel like people have focused more on the creepy journalist stuff, the tabloid stuff, right? Because I honestly think that's the stuff that really undid her, and certainly it was the stuff that when she started having breakdowns, blew it up to the point where we decided that she was insane, right? So
yeah,
and it kind of bugs me because I think so many of the women who are railing about the sexuality part of this are still willfully, gleefully participating in the tabloid culture part of it that I think really drove not just her, but like how many? Lindsay Lohan's a perfectly great example. Yeah. There are a ton of them in this movie, yeah, right? Of people who are just constantly followed and harassed and have themselves waiting for someone just to slip up so that they can make a buck. I mean, you know, we've been in LA, you see this stuff. You just see it around.
It's deeply disturbing. And tabloid culture is a seriously fucked up thing and remains that to this day. And I don't know how much it's changed at all, really. And
it hasn't at all. And that's kind of what I mean, is it's like people are still gleefully consuming these photos and video images and jumping on TMZ and doing all of it. Right. You know, and I'm as guilty of it as I abhor tabloids, but you know what, when there's a big celebrity scandal story, it's like, you know, TMZ is going to have the goods. Right. So it's like, you're waiting for them to report shit.
No doubt. And
makes me complicit too. You
100%.
Know?
Yeah. And I thought one of the most disturbing things in this documentary was the paparazzo they interviewed, who clearly felt like he was an ally of Britney's and literally stared at the camera and said things like, and this is a slight oversimplification, but basically was saying things like, well, yeah, no, I mean, I heard her say the tabloids were ruining her life and she was, you know, deeply upset about never having any privacy and she didn't want to be followed, but I just never thought she was talking about me, really.
Right.
And it's, you know, like,
and yet I also understand, it's like, if pictures of her, single photos of her, are selling for $1 million, you know, like, of course people are going to go do that work, right? Like, well, how else are they going to ever make that kind of money?
And
you know?
That's why this all unfortunately, not unlike the first film we discussed, this all comes back to the horrors of capitalism.
Right.
You know, that but, is not, this is not a, I'm not sure this is a solvable problem in a capitalist society because.
And that's right. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but that kind of comes back to us, doesn't it? Right. Those pictures are worth $1 million because we wanted to watch the car crash. Right.
Yeah. Literally and figuratively. This. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
No, I mean, it's, you know, that just because you said car crash, like that's. It's the story of Diana, too, right? I mean, there's so many for such a long time. There's so many stories that essentially involve the paparazzi dismantling the lives of famous people. And when we say the paparazzi dismantle the lives of famous people, what we are really saying is anybody who wants to see that picture and opens up that tabloid and logs on to TMZ, which is such a huge percentage of people, we're all dismantling these celebrities. We all are.
Yep.
And it does that's why I said, like, it, this is a big old mirror, this documentary, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, 100%. And I genuinely think that level of fame is unhealthy for
there's no question. Some people handle it better than others, but there's no question. It's bad. It's unhealthy for anybody. There's no way being it's essentially like you're being stalked constantly by a big group of approved stalkers.
Yeah. So what do you make of the Free Britney movement? You know what I mean? I'm not talking about the cause. I'm talking about the movement, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? The people who are analyzing her Instagram on podcasts and staging protests and all that stuff.
I think it's really tough because, as we just said, it's part of the – like, those people are desperate for any news about Britney, which means there are people out there desperately – trying to ferret out by whatever means necessary any news they can about Britney. And so in a way, I think the Free Britney movie contributes to the problem. On the other hand, without the Free Britney movie, does this film ever happen and are we ever having this conversation?
Yeah.
So in some ways, I think they're necessary. In most ways, I think most of those people have pretty pure intentions. You know, whatever the root of them, which might be a little weird, they actually... I think believe they're doing what's in Britney's best interest. They actually, I think, have tried to do their research and want what they think is a good thing for her. And she seems, by virtue of this latest court posting, to feel seen and assisted in some way by those people, lifted up by those people in some way. And, you know, based on what I just watched, I would like her to feel as lifted up as she can. But it's all part of the machine that led to this. So it's really hard for me to know how to feel about that.
It's tough because, right, I agree with you 100%. I think everybody's intentions are pure. I think almost anybody involved in it genuinely – like wants to help her and believes that they are helping her. And I think, you know, you can make the case that it's been a positive force in her life, but it's also just a case. And there doesn't seem to be any awareness on the people involved that, like, this is none of your business. This is none of your business. You know what I mean? Like, she is not asking for your help. Like, there are some cryptic signs that she's maybe not opposed to it. You know what I mean? But she could easily come out and say, like, that she supported this if she wanted to, right? And the fact that she hasn't, I think, is noteworthy, correct? So
I don't know, because when that line in the court filing is really interesting. Like, that's a totally extraneous, unnecessary thing for a court filing. There's absolutely no reason to say in a court filing, Britney appreciates the informed support of her fans. Like, that is,
yes.
That's, I don't know what you could interpret that as other than a message to the Free Britney movement.
But
that,
you
like,
don't,
You know what, guys?
But you don't even know that Britney wrote that, right? Like, that's a lawyer wrote that. So,
but a lawyer who is really the only person in all of this that in any way directly represents Britney's interests and desires.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Like, I'm not questioning the lawyer per se. I'm just saying, like, Britney is not locked in a basement with her mouth covered in duct tape. Like,
well, it's very opaque.
She's on Instagram.
Right?
She, you know what I mean? Like,
she's on Instagram, but she's clearly not using it freely. Like, that's why the low information part of this is so frustrating, is because you're right, she's not chained to a pole in a basement, but is she concerned that sharing her feelings openly will be just another piece of ammunition for her father trying to keep her under conservatorship? She might be.
I think she's concerned that it's another piece of ammunition for the whole world.
That's what I'm saying. Right? For everyone to say, oh, now she's ranting and raving about her dad. She must be crazy.
She's
right?
Well, like, or unwell.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I'm not even talking about ranting or raving. Like, she could just thumbs up, thumbs down on Free Britney. If she posted hashtag Free Britney one time, you know what I mean? Like,
are you? But again,
I don't think anybody's going to call her crazy for that.
Well, I'm not going to call her crazy. You're not going to call her crazy. But are we sure her father's not going to take that to court and say, see, she's Instagramming about these insane people on the street that she doesn't even know. And like, she's clearly not well.
I think that'd be hard to say that she's unwell based on that. You know what I mean?
Well,
but that's the other thing is, you know, because this is a low information situation, we have no idea what's going on with her medically, mental health wise.
Right. I mean, fundamentally, that's the problem. But I will say this. I will say this about, you know, what we do know about her mental health. I will say first, I was shocked would be strong, because look, I didn't follow Britney that closely, even when she was a big deal and her, you know, alleged mental collapse was a big deal. But having the story told in retrospect, from age 12, she is, when you dig into it, much more aware and on top of her career and in control of what's happening, and like, both artistically and intellectually understanding of the situation than was generally portrayed throughout her life by a mile. And two, viewed in retrospect, the things that led us to call her insane seem very reasonable.
Yeah, I think that last part is, you know, I think more than fair.
Well,
you know,
that's kind of my point. So if you're someone who's basically my age, like, she's practically 40. If you're someone, you know, going on 40, who's been in a conservatorship for a decade over things that you still feel were, like, yeah, acting out a little bit, but basically reasonable responses to insane invasions of privacy and intrusions into her life and, you know, inappropriate attacks from old people, you might very well be terrified to say anything of note publicly that could possibly be used against you in any way. Viewed from that angle, I kind of understand her not wanting to weigh in publicly on anything that might have to do with this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but she sort of does. Like, that's a thing. Like,
but she only does it in ways that have plausible deniability. She doesn't do anything directly, and I think that to me is important to at least to my understanding of what I feel like Britney is doing. You know, specifically right now, a huge part of the way I understand it is the notion that things she did in the past to try to stand up for herself that felt reasonable to her were used to put her in this unreasonable situation. Yeah. So a choice to not say anything specific or direct in public view makes sense to me, even if it seems like Instagramming hashtag Free Britney one time isn't a big deal. Yeah. If other things that felt like not a big deal at the time were then used to basically put you in a, you know, virtual prison, I get it.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think we're in the same place at this point, which is basically like, she's a damn near 40-year-old woman. And if a court that has all the information determines that she needs some sort of, you know, professional financial management, great. If they determine that she needs some sort of professional addiction and or mental health services, then great. But I do not understand why she would need to be tied to her father at this point in her life when she is clearly an adult, a mother,
yep,
making an incredibly productive amount of income. Like, yep, like, let her live, man. Just let her live.
And, you know? Just, like, yeah, just the fact that her father and his business partners have already tried to bilk more money out of the situation without considering giving her life back tells me that they should not be involved. I mean, it just seems pretty clear that they should not be involved.
Yeah. Cut that dude's faucet off. For
exactly.
Sure.
Let's get happy.
He'll be fine.
Can we talk about something happy?
Sure. Sure. Look, all right, so we're on to All the Boys. What was the name of this one?
Always and Forever, I think.
Always and Forever. Yep. Okay. Yeah. You know, certainly this was the easiest watch.
Oh yeah.
Of all of these things. And like the things that were great about To Love To All the Boys that we have loved before, you know, the charming people,
yep,
and circumstances.
The tux on the little sister. Whew, it's a hell of a, yeah, tux.
it was a great tux. you know, so watching these characters grow a little bit over the years, all of that stuff is great. But like, I'm a little concerned that we have maybe wrung the juice out of this three movies on, you know what I mean? And that we are now mostly just doing this sort of like Restoration Hardware catalog fulfillment for teenage girls. You know what I mean? Like, look at this perfect life that you could have, you
this,
know?
This by far of the three was the one that felt the most like it wasn't for me. And it was really for a teenage girl. This was the other ones. Look, I like a romantic comedy, and I like teen melodrama. So, you know, in some ways, this is for me. But this one just felt so specifically directed towards a high school aged woman. You know, there was just so much about it that was like, this is really for someone who wants to be Lana Condor.
Yes. Yeah.
I enjoyed it. It was fun. I think I'm done watching To All the Boys movies, probably.
and I think they're done making them. Oof. For a bit.
They sure left the door open, though, didn't they? I mean, they left that door wide open. Like, yeah. I, on one hand, I agree. On the other hand, it would not surprise me if To All the Boys I Loved Before the Number is coming out a year from today. like that would not shock me. But there was part of me that wanted a postscript for this movie that was like, I don't even remember the characters' names, but that was like, Lana Condor and Noah Centineo broke up 4 months later, but everything was fine and they went on to live normal lives. You know? Like that's,
yeah,
that's because that's what happens in real life in this movie for the most part is like,
but they're not those other couples. I they're know. Peter and Laura Jean.
I know, but there it is. Peter and Laura Jean. But like a postscript of like, actually they are those other couples. They broke up 4 months later. Peter became, you know, had a successful college lacrosse career and went into a hedge fund when he graduated, and Lana Condor became a writer for the New Yorker. Like, great. Good job, everybody. They had good lives.
They
and
100%
went on...
cheated on each other freshman year. 100%.
Exactly. And then they married other people that they met after college, and everything was okay. Like that, and I would have been satisfied with that. And then I would have known we don't have to do this anymore. But I don't want to crap all over this movie because it's really totally harmless and largely enjoyable. It's just you could sort of see the road running out over the course of the movie, and the runway ended at the end of the movie, and there's no more runway.
Agreed. It was a fun time, and you know, it's we've gotten to the third one, and yes, it's very easy to pick some nits, including take your visit to freaking San Francisco, Lord Gene Covey.
Come on.
You know what I mean? Like,
come on,
man. I think you might find plenty of city and a hell of a lot of good cookies in the city of San Francisco.
Seriously.
Like, you'd be okay. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Try it out.
There are other cities, and they have fucking subways and shit. You could do all of that stuff.
Not in San Francisco, but yeah, you could go to other places with subways. I agree. The look, I'm always going to bristle at the incredibly popular among New Yorkers, and also so blatantly pompous and obnoxious view that New York is the only city that matters. It's so dumb. It's always been dumb. It's a dirty, shitty city in reality.
It's the least charming thing about them. You got the most things. Congrats.
Yeah, good job. You got the most things. None of you are doing them, but you do have the most things. The only people doing them are people who come to visit for a high school trip. But yeah, no, you got a lot of shit there.
I know.
That's and it's great. Also filthy.
One of those... Like, I just wanted to be like, you're never going to do any of those things again when you live there.
Right. Exactly. Oh, there's a band at an NYU party. Congratulations. There were bands at parties at Pomona College of 1600 in Claremont, California. You know, congratulations. Like, I'm not impressed. And that's annoying.
Yeah. That was a really nice roof for a college party.
Yeah.
Which gets back into the restoration hardware thing.
Totally.
Anyway.
Shove it up your ass, New York.
Yeah. You know, it's fine. Look, I'm not going to get into it's 2020 and you know, she's making all these decisions about gloriously expensive colleges, and there's zero conversation about how she's going to pay for it, how they're going to pay for it.
Right.
Or any of that stuff. But
he's a doctor. You know, yeah, her dad's a doctor. Everything's fine.
Dad's a doctor. Everything's good. I mean, you know. It's got one kid in college already and another one coming up the pike, but it's fine.
Look, who doesn't have $400,000 or $500,000 to spare?
I would love for John Corbett to play a couple of dicks in some things. You know what I mean?
Instead of like, just a nice guy.
Like, he's obviously he's so great at these, and I'm not knocking, like, he's lovely to have around in this movie. He's great as the dad. But yeah, God, I've seen him do this so many times now.
Yeah, I don't know if part of it is just that we've seen this literal movie three times now, but it might be too late for John Corbett to do something different.
Yeah, he may be stuck. He may be stuck. You know, it's a look. I'm sure it's a good and lucrative niche to keep
sure.
doing that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Look, I've heard Netflix pays very well.
But, you know, I would like to see it. And he's, you know, look, he's graying now, which is working out for him, too. Good for him. All right. I think that's all I got to all the boys.
Yeah. I don't think there's a lot to say here. I think we've covered it pretty well.
Before we go for homework, and I know I'm making a mistake by jumping into the world of sports real quick. I'm just curious because, you know, there's a lot of all-star debate going on now.
You mean about whether they should do it at all?
No, about who's going to make the team.
Oh.
Honestly, I feel like whether they should do it at all is – it's not even really a debate. It's obvious that they shouldn't do it, and yet
correct.
They're going to do it anyway.
Correct.
Right? Like,
yes. Agreed. So we can move on from that.
Yeah. Is there even a side for they should do it?
Money.
Like, I guess.
That's it.
Yeah. How much money are they making, though?
I don't know. Must be a lot. I mean, I
is
hope
it
it's a lot.
We needed to deliver this to TNT sort of thing to get.
Yeah.
I don't.
I think in some ways it is, although TNT, from all the reporting I've seen, TNT had already chalked it up as a loss. So I think it's more we have to keep making all the money all the time.
Like, people barely want to watch this game in normal times.
That's what I thought. I people tell me every year that I'm the only one who likes the NBA All-Star game, and yet all of a sudden the NBA desperately has to put it on. I don't get it.
like just pick the teams. But anyway, I was just curious for you as a Chicago Bulls fan, where you are on Zach LaVine borderline All-Star.
He's not a borderline All-Star. He's an obvious All-Star.
All-Star.
Of course. I don't really understand the question. The pigeonholing of Zach LaVine is one of the very strongest arguments for my new crusade about NBA basketball, which is most of you are not watching. I mean, it's just that simple. Since he became a Chicago Bull, Zach LaVine has consistently improved as a shooter, as a passer, and at least effort-wise, as a defender. He's just gotten better and better. And do you know how old he is today? He's 25 years old.
Well, I was going to say 26.
He's 25 years old. I mean, he turns 26 in a few weeks, but he's 25 years old. No one can stay in front of him. He's averaging 28-5-5, and he's shooting percentages that Steph Curry would be happy with. So what are we talking about?
We're talking about, like, you know, his team's not really good.
Since when is that the standard for All-Stars? For MVPs, okay. But since when is your team's record isn't good enough? Since when is that the standard for All-Stars? It's never been the standard before.
It's not about the standard, but
is Bradley Beal an All-Star?
Yeah, Bradley Beal's an All-Star.
Yeah. Zach LaVine is the second best shooting guard in the Eastern Conference. So what are we talking about?
Well, I mean, what position? I mean, who is the Brooklyn Nets shooting guard?
Kyrie Irving. He said it himself. I'd rather have Zach LaVine.
Well, all right. So, I mean, look, Zach LaVine is a borderline All-Star in that there's 12 guys that are going to be on this team, and there's like 9 locks that I would say don't include him, right? So then he's like, is he guaranteed better player than Trae Young right now? A more deserving All-Star than Trae Young?
Yes. Like, yes.
All right. I'm not sure I agree with you, but
really,
but
is that
right.
Is that because you're an Atlanta guy?
I don't watch a lot of Zach LaVine. No.
Would you like to hear? Would you like to hear Trae Young's shooting percentages?
I would like to hear Trae Young's shooting percentages.
He's 41.7 from the field, 36.4 from 3-point percentage, and a 47.9. So basically, 48% effective field goal percentage. And he's also scoring less than Zach LaVine, and he is worse defensively. And again, not assisting a little more.
Okay.
But he's a point guard. He's a point guard who shoots constantly, makes bad decisions down the stretch, and isn't scoring as well as Zach LaVine. And scoring, while yes, look, his assists are great. I like Trae Young. But he's just not playing as well as Zach LaVine, and his team is not better.
Isn't any better? No,
they're worse.
I honestly don't think Zach LaVine is going to make the All-Star team. If you're asking me what's going to happen,
I think you're probably right, and I think it's ridiculous. I think it's ridiculous. But I think it's just because most people haven't watched him since Minnesota, literally.
Yeah, the Bulls are fairly invisible. Unless you're seeking them out, right? Like, so.
Yeah, and I get that, but like, don't. It's low information voters, and it annoys me, because people say things like, "Well, he's not a passer. You know, all he cares about is his own offense. He's not trying on defense." And it's just like you're not watching. He's that team's leader, and yeah, they're not playing great, but he is. He is.
So,
and there's a lot of other problems that are not his fault.
So do you feel like, and you feel like he's a guy that you could build around, and that there you could have a winning team with Zach LaVine as the two?
Of course. I don't know if you can have a contender with Zach LaVine as your best player, but that's not the criteria for All-Star. I don't know if you can have a contender with Bradley Beal as your best player. I don't.
I was just more curious about how you, as a Bulls fan, felt about Zach LaVine as player.
I think it's obvious that he is playing at an All-Star level. I just think it's obvious.
Yeah, but there are there are going to be several guys in the East, especially, which is weird to say, who are playing at an all-star level that are not going to make the all-star team.
And there's going to be several guys on the team who don't deserve to be there. So that's what happens. I don't know. Like Westbrook
look,
probably has a
think,
better chance of making the team than Zach LaVine. And to me, that is absurd.
That I don't know. I don't think Russell Westbrook's going to make this team. But we'll see. I mean, you would at least say, you know, if Kyrie Irving makes the team ahead of Zach LaVine, that's, you know, an arguable decision, right?
It's arguable that Kyrie Irving is better than Zach LaVine. We can have that debate. But their stats are pretty similar. In fact, I would argue LaVine's are maybe a tick better, depending on what you value. You know, Kyrie shoots free throws better, but it's 91-85. Zach LaVine's averaging more rebounds, same amount of assists, basically, same amount of points, basically.
And he has 0 2-week disappearances during the season.
Exactly. And there's really no question about whether he's like, I don't know.
Whether he thinks the earth is round or not.
That's a whole other ball of wax that I don't know that totally matters.
I know. It doesn't factor in the all-star voting. I just want to make fun of Kyrie.
Their stats are very similar, and Kyrie Irving is in a much better situation and also walked away from the team mysteriously for a couple weeks. Yeah. So to me, that would give the all-star nod to Zach LaVine, but I have no illusions that I think there's a 0% chance that Zach LaVine makes this team and Kyrie Irving doesn't. Because Kyrie Irving is viewed as a very specific thing. And by the way, Kyrie Irving is also 3 years older than Zach LaVine.
Yeah, wild. I think people have Zach LaVine in the Karl Towns bucket, right? You know?
Yeah. Because they haven't watched him since those two were playing together.
Yeah. So Karl Towns not gonna make the team either.
Well, yeah, and he hasn't played. But again, I'm not really mad at Kyrie Irving making the team. I don't understand the discourse around Zach LaVine is what I don't understand. Sometimes good players – look, Damian Lillard didn't make the All-Star team for years when he was playing exceptional basketball, so it's not that big a deal. It's just the way Zach LaVine is talked about, I think, is ignorant.
Yeah. Well, I think he's slowly moving into a new category of recognition, but him and I think Trey probably gonna have to figure out how to win some games before people take them particularly seriously.
Maybe
just could
be
what it is.
Could be. And the Bulls have a lot of work to do with that roster. Billy Donovan has a lot of work to do clearing out the cobwebs left there by a decade of terrible coaches. There's a lot of work to do, but none of it falls on Zach LaVine in my view.
Fair enough. All right, let's jump into homework because we have a fair amount of that this week and we got to get out of here. We will start with Young Rock, which airs tonight, and I have no idea if it's going to be any good. But
did you happen to watch the Rock and his mother on the Jimmy Fallon show?
I did not. I don't think I've ever happened to watch the Jimmy Fallon show.
Well, I mean, I didn't watch the show. I saw it on the internet, but it was delightful. I mean, for a good time, I recommend watching The Rock. Apparently, Jimmy and The Rock's mom had a previous relationship. And, you know, they're all doing stuff from home. And The Rock's in Hawaii with his family. And they're, like, talking. And Jimmy mentions his mom. And he's like, oh, actually, she's right here. And then she, like, comes on the screen and plays some ukulele. It's incredibly cute.
That's dope.
And it made me more interested in Young Rock. Look.
Yeah. And the previews have not looked terrible.
No, so, and I just, I am, also it's Anachna Khan, the woman who created The Bee in Apartment 23, which I think is one of the great underrated network sitcoms of the last 20 years. So I'm hopeful that this could actually really be good.
Yep, I agree. And then Thursday there's a new miniseries coming to HBO Max called It's a Sin. Which is set in London in the 80s and getting some really good buzz. So we'll check that out. I'm going to guess you're going to get a lot of Pet Shop Boys music in that from the title. and then we've got two movies for you. on Netflix, I Care a Lot, starring Rosamund Pike, and Nomadland, which you've seen probably seen a lot of commercials for and is getting some awards buzz. And you can find that on Hulu. And there you go. That is a full slate of homework with, of course, an episode of The Challenge in between.
Very excited. Can't wait. I will talk to you Thursday about The Challenge. Bye. You want to try that again?
Jumped in there quick with a bye. I was going to say it sounds good, so I don't know that we need to recut that for that.
Okay, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.